Microphone isn't sounding, microphone's not sounding great, Monica. No offense, but it's a little blurry today. Oh, good morning. Welcome.
That what you said?
Yeah, your mic is just kind of like th
No.
distorted.
Okay.
It's, well, just don't talk. Sorry. Not that we don't love you. All right, it is Tuesday, May 28th, and it's 2024. I've been really appreciating how the sun doesn't go down too early lately. It's really another one of those things, you know, when you move to California, you partly come here so that the weather will always be good. And then I'm like, okay, could we also have like the sun always be up till 8 o'clock at night, please? So I'm not sure that that's possible on this planet. I know you could go to the southern hemisphere in the winter, but I think that whole equinox thing messes it up. But anyway, enough climate reports. So we are going to meditate for 20 minutes, and today our topic is the paramis. We are not going to get through them all, but that'll be a good. So one of these days we're going to turn this into a podcast, and we'll have to have a name for every class. So this one is going to be called the paramis. All right, for future reference, if anybody in the future is listening to this. All right. Settling back into a comfortable posture. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze, turning the attention inward. At first, just feeling how you're holding your body. Making sure that you're comfortable and stable. Having a sense of arriving, settling. Each time we return the attention to the body, we're discovering the experience of this present moment, discovering our body in this moment. Noticing if there's any areas of tension or tightness that can be softened. And then feeling the breath, the movement of breath, breathing in, breathing out. The touch sensations of breath coming in, going out. Just feeling how the momentum of the mind, the momentum of the body can have you feeling as if you are moving forward, or as if there's a stream of thoughts or energies. Mindfulness encourages us to just be with this experience. And in that being with, there can be a natural calming that happens. We don't have to force that or make it happen. But through focusing in the present moment, the felt experience with the openness without resistance, everything begins to settle. The mind may carry your attention away. When you notice that, simply come back, bring the attention back to the breath. Perhaps more than anything, it's grasping after thoughts that keeps us out of the present. And we can feel this almost as a physical grip, tightness. So if you're aware of that felt experience, to breathe with that open, soften. It's through letting go, not through suppressing, that thoughts diminish. Through non-resistance. Other times we may become aware of the quiet that lives beneath the stream of thoughts. And so we shift our perspective, our point of view, instead of being fascinated by the thoughts, to look beneath that, to sense the space of mind in which thoughts are happening. Stillness of mind is not something that we create or build, but rather something we attune to. As we lose interest in the proliferation of thoughts, their power to distract is weakened. And then naturally, what emerges is this openness, stillness that lives within us. Okay. Because my interface has changed, it's quite a bit more elaborate for me to fix it so the bell rings properly. I'm not sure why that's happened, but well, there's somebody who wanted to skip the meditation and just show up for the talk. Welcome. All right, folks. Nice to see everyone. And I had a really busy April, a lot of teaching, and then May, I taught one retreat, and then just pretty much this class. And so I'm feeling, it's interesting. I complain about working too much, but then I'm not working, kind of like I need it. So I appreciate you guys showing up and enjoy being able to do this each week. And so, as I mentioned, we're going to talk about the paramis. So again, going back to this wonderful book called More Than Mindfulness from the Abhayagiri Monastery, which is a free book, which makes it kind of tricky because you can't buy it. As which makes sense, it's a tree, but you can't order it from Amazon. Excuse me. Might need a cough drop. In any case, you can get it from the Abhayagiri website. You can download it as a as an ebook or a PDF in various formats, and it's a collection. I know most of you know this by now, but a collection of talks from the different monks affiliated with the Abhayagiri and Amaravati monasteries in the Thai forest tradition of Ajahn Chah. So this particular talk is called The Paramis as Practices of Liberation, and it's by Ajahn Jayasaro, who was actually, he lives mostly in Thailand, and he wrote a voluminous book on Ajahn Chah's life, on a kind of biography of Ajahn Chah, and which really also includes sort of a whole description of the world of Ajahn Chah's monasteries. So you see how the people live there, and all the details of that that world in northeast Thailand. So in any case, this talk is on the paramis. The paramis, it's usually translated as perfections, and it's 10 qualities that the Buddha is said to have perfected over many lifetimes. And I actually didn't finish doing notes on the talk, because it's quite, there's so many, because there's 10, and it's a lot. And and I'm not, this is one of the lists that I'm not, I have not firmly embedded in my mind, but I will go over the ones here that I have here, and then hopefully I'll remember the others. Dana, which is generosity; sila, morality; renunciation or letting go; wisdom; patience; energy. So that's one. That's how many I have: two, three, four, five, six. And so there's also loving kindness, concentration, equanimity. That gets me up to nine, and determination. I think I got it. From Ajahn Jayasaro's talk, which if you have the paperback, this talk starts on page 61 of More Than Mindfulness. And one of the things he says, which is interesting, is that there The paramis aren't actually in found in the suttas, which I didn't realize. There are some good books on the paramis. Actually, Sylvia Boorstein has a nice book. What's it called? So it's got one of her clever titles. I'm going to go look at it up. Sorry, excuse me. Pay attention for goodness sake, but I apologize. Nothing like dead air. It's called Pay Attention for Goodness Sake. And the reason I bring that book up is because it's if you're familiar with Sylvia Boorstein, she kind of presents the Dharma in this very accessible way, and sometimes people will think of it as being very light, kind of the way people think of Thich Nhat Hanh as light. But when you delve into what they're doing, you realize, oh, there's really kind of a genius in here. And what she does that's particularly interesting in that book is she takes the 10 perfections, she builds a chart, and it's it lists the 10 perfections, and then it has all these connections to the Four Noble Truths and other Buddhist teachings. So it sort of frames them in a really, really interesting way. So I don't often, well, I do like to talk. I like to t share about books because I know people are always looking for Dharma books. But I think that's a really interesting one. And that the rest of the book is sort of s simple. I mean, but that chart is really quite interesting. All right, get back to the topic at hand. So a few things from Ajahn Jayasaro. He starts out by talking about one of the great similes from the Buddha, which is that the Dharma has one taste, like in the same way that the ocean has one taste, that wherever you go in the world, the ocean is salty, and that the Dharma has one taste. It's the taste of liberation or the taste of freedom, all through his teachings. He says about the paramis, he says he thinks of them as supporting factors rather than techniques. He says, these days we can easily become obsessed with content and technique and believe that problems in our practice can always be solved by spiritual technologies or by information, that we just need some special tip or some secret key. And I think that's a really helpful idea, because I think there's always this tendency. I think many of us fall into this tendency to think, oh, like I need to find the right meditation practice that's going to sort of do the magic, that's going to fix me, or it's going to, like, I'm going to get super concentrated, or whatever it is that we're sort of seeking after. And, you know, and that is very typical of our Western society. That's it's a very materialistic kind of view of meditation. You know, like it's about figuring out the right way to do it, and that there's a thing, an object that I need to get the right thing, which happens to be a meditation technique. You know, oh, if I get the right mantra, you know, or even it can be, you know, if I find the right teacher, oh, that teacher. You know, and we can have a moment, you know, you find a technique, or you find a teacher, or you're on some retreat and you have some experience to think, oh, now I've found it, right? And And then you start to again project outward, like the thing is out there that I need. And people get obsessed with teachers in this way, and particularly in some of the more devotional areas, like, oh, my teacher, and forgetting that it's all in here and that it's all impermanent. That there isn't a way, an external way to control the internal experience that's going to be, a permanent thing that and so I think really important to recognize that this practice is not about getting it right and learning the technique. Oh, let me how do I where should I pay attention to the breath? And how do I let go of thoughts? Oh, there's a practice for how to let go of thoughts. Oh, I'm going to work on that. For me, it's very much, again, one of my persistent themes, but you guys keep showing up, I'm going to keep saying the same stuff. It's j just like recovery. It's about one day at a time showing up. Just consistency, and that's where the development happens, and that's where the magic happens. And we'll have moments, and that'll be powerful and rich. And then there'll be moments when we feel like we've completely lost it, and we don't know what's happening. But if you don't drink or use, and if you don't like give up on your meditation, then it's all grist for the mill, as Ram Dass. One of his book titles, it all becomes part of the development, which again I think is so important and so hard for us, right? We all struggle with this, but that the hard times are value just as valuable as the good times, and that we learn and grow through the difficulties as much as we do, might be more, right? We're forced to grow in the difficult times. We're forced to confront when you're trying to meditate and everything's just chaotic. That's when you're forced to, like, oh, wait, what, let me, how can I work with this? Whereas if you're sitting there and your mind is just like, oh, everything's really peaceful, this is great, I've got it now, you're not really challenging yourself. And I mean, that's not that you have to challenge yourself all the time, but I'm just saying, like, not to think that the difficult times are a waste or getting in the way of something, that they are, in fact, what allows you to progress and deepen in your practice. Okay, I haven't even gotten into the paramis yet. So Jayasaro calls the paramis a hidden and unknowable factor involved in our progress on the path. And he calls developing them spiritual maturity. I think this is a useful idea. Spiritual maturity is an idea that's really important to me. And it's part of what I'm talking, it is what I'm talking about. The idea that I'm going to get fixed by some external practice is not a mature, a spiritually mature viewpoint, right? It's a typical kind of beginner, not begin, whatever, less cultivated viewpoint. We haven't learned the bigger picture yet. Just as with recovery, again, early recovery, we can get into these magical, like, oh, now I can always find a parking place, sort of, sobriety, that, like, it's all just like happening, and then you hit a roadblock, using some automobile metaphors here, where things get really tough, and oh man, like, I've really lost it. Like, what do I, what step do I need to work right now? Or what did I do? And it's like, no, that's just life. Like, that's what happens. And, you lose a job, you break up with somebody dies, there's struggles, and And going through all that, all the ups and downs, right? And learning to navigate that, that's maturity. And that's just emotional maturity as well as spiritual maturity. All right, let's get into the first of the paramis, dana. So dana, typically is translated as generosity, and practically the only time that you hear about dana is like when people are asking you to give them money. At the end of a retreat, typically there's a lot of talk about dana, and sometimes on here we ask for dana, and but dana is more than that, and it's as a practice. Well, let me quote Jayasaro. He says it's about being liberated from stinginess and meanness and attachment to our possessions and wealth. But he says it's when we give the mind experiences its initial form of freedom. It's a great joy. So again, I would take it out of this idea of even a stinginess or money, and think of it as generosity of heart, because I think, the first place and maybe the more significant place that we work with this is in our relationships, and when people want something from us, and here we can look at, or when people need something from us, we can look at our own relationship to that, which is, might be one of stinginess, of like, I don't have time for you, this is too much, but it could very often go to the other extreme, right? To giving away too much, giving away my time and my energy to others and not conserving it and using it for my own needs. So this is obviously a codependence and Al-Anon kind of behavior. And so looking at our relationship to this, how do I be a generous, compassionate, caring person who is also generous, caring, and compassionate to myself in a wholesome way that works for me? And as with most elements of the Dharma, there isn't a hard and fast rule. And I think we many of us would love to have the hard and fast rules, like people at the end of a retreat. Well, how much should I give, or what's the typical amount or whatever? And it's like there's no answer to that. It's very personal. But I think of, I mean, I connect with the idea of Dana around being generous with people, and even like attention seeking. Like I'm not a naturally generous person, and I'm not a naturally caretaking person. So, being the Dharma teacher and being the person who gets to talk, that's really comfortable for me, because it's like I'm getting the attention and I'm talking and my ideas. Then when other, I've learned, I realized at some point that I wasn't good at having conversations with people. I mean, this is, more than a few years ago, but that if I wasn't talking, I didn't know, I had to learn to ask people questions. I started to notice that, like, people would ask me questions, and I realized, oh, that's how you have a conversation. When I run out of things to say, or when I realize their eyes are glazing over, oh, ask them a question. And it was learning, and it's generosity of spirit. I'll tell you, somebody who's really good at this is Vimalasara. She was over for dinner with us last week. And just me and my wife and Vimalasara, because I wanted her to meet Rosemary and just have some hang time with her. And if you don't know who she is, she's a very special Dharma teacher in recovery. And we had just been teaching a retreat together at Big Bear. And I noticed that she started asking my wife questions, and then I was like, you know what? I'm going to ask Vimala Sar some questions. And I started asking her about her life. I was like, this is, but I pointed that out. I said that to her. Wow, I've become aware now, because I've noticed in my last couple times I've hung out with her that she was re really probing me about my life and my family and stuff. And I asked her about it, and she said, oh, well, I think it comes from my background as a journalist, which was interesting. But anyway, just an aside, So th this is Donna, right? So again, when we limit the idea of jo Donna to being about money, we really lose important aspects of it, of being generous. How are we doing? Okay. So the second paramiya sila, it's often translated as morality, ethical behavior. Again, something that can be much broader than that. It's not just a list of rights and right and wrong. It starts traditionally with the precepts, but has much broader implications than that. And the sort of short way of summing up sila is non-harming. The precepts is about non-harming, which of course then has a positive side, which is doing acts of kindness. Ajahn Chah says that sila liberates us from the bad karma we might create. So I was coming down the 101, north of through Marin on Sunday, and they had one of these flashing road signs. It said, "Stay sober, save lives." I was like, wow, that's really an interesting sign. Stay sober, save lives. Like, people don't usually think, oh, I'm not going to drink because I want to save people's lives. And we don't think of ourselves, those of you who are sober from alcohol, we don't think of ourselves as like, I'm not drinking today so that I won't kill people, But, that's one of the outcomes, that you tend to have fewer car accidents. And of course, that's one of the main ways that people die in our country. So this, reminds me of some of the teachings I've heard from Venerable Inalio and Ajahn Pasano about how living by the precepts, which the five precepts are to not kill, not to steal, not to harm sexually, not to lie, not to use intoxicants, and those can be expanded on and elaborated, but that's the basic ones, that when we follow those, it's an act of compassion to not do these forms of harm. And again, it sort of think you think of it as like, well, I'm not really doing anything, but to realize that not doing can be an act of compassion, that's very meaningful. I find it like it's like getting a bonus, right? Like, I didn't do anything. What am I being praised for? Oh, you're being praised for not doing anything. Like, that's good, that you didn't do any of those things. And as I like to point out, although particularly for a sober person who, for anybody who's living by basic precepts, we may not think that it's a big deal that we don't kill people. But if we look at the larger world, there's a lot of killing. There's a lot of killing. There's a lot of stealing. There's a lot of sexual harm. There's a lot of lying. Those are the four moral precepts. Sobriety or not using intoxicants isn't considered a moral precept. But those four, you know, it's heartbreaking. You know, when we live, you know, I mean, I look at you guys, I don't know what exactly what your lives are like, you know, obviously, but I'm gonna trust that, you know, you're basically living in this way. And that after a while, you don't really think that much about it. You know, you don't think like, oh, I should get a gold star or I'm doing something special. But enough of the world is doing harm on one or more of these levels on a regular basis that the fact that we're not doing it is a big deal, is really important. We are, you know, doing our part to heal the world, you know. And as I like to point out, if everybody in the world just followed one precept, you know, and you can pick one, doesn't matter which one, the world would be a completely different place. If no one ever lied, you know, if no one ever killed anybody, you know, just one of those. If no one ever stole anything. You know, and we that for me, that reflection is what really points to the depth of this question and this issue. It's like, well, that's unimaginable. We can't imagine that everybody would follow one simple precept. And yet you hear the precepts, you think, well, that's they're no big deal. So just to see how precious and vital they are, and how, you know, I think in that, I can't even remember if I was listening to a talk from Ajahn Amaro actually, and he was talking about he was actually at Insight Meditation Society. This was like the week before last or last week maybe. And he was talking about how living at a retreat center or at a monastery, you know, you leave your belongings around and you don't worry about anybody stealing them. And that the sense of safety and comfort that people feel in an environment like that. And if we could live in a world like that, what a different world it would be. I mean, psychologically, what an incredibly different world it would be, right? Because how much of our anxiety and trauma comes through other people breaking the precepts, you know, or fear of someone breaking the precepts. You know, my wife is like, don't leave anything in the car that people can see that they might want to steal because there's a lot of smash and grab goes on. I mean, what a thing to have to think about. Like, I'm just parking my car in front of the house. Like, and I have to, like, I'm going to take this book out of the back seat so nobody will break into my car. Yeah. Sila. Phew. Well, I got like 5 more minutes. I've gotten through 2 of the 10. So, yeah, so let me open it up because I've talked a lot and I will be an act of generosity by opening it up and not being taking all the time. To speak, because it's this we can take a few weeks to go through these paramis. So, anybody want to speak to Donna or to Sila or really anything else?
Hi, Kevin. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure.
So I'm new to this practice, coming from a background of Zen, and I'm actually taking the Satipatthana course through the Barry Institute with Venerable. Yeah. And I've also been watching a lot of your videos on YouTube, after discovering you through your books in recovery. And I've heard you mention a couple of times about mindfulness practice in states of depression. Could you just elaborate a little bit on that? I know it's a little off topic, but
Oh, it's always a good topic. Evergreen, as we say.
It's very relevant right now for me. So I was just
Yeah, well, I'm sorry that
in
that's
my
you're dealing with that, and it's, yeah, I think probably for addicts it's a pretty common. Yeah, so I guess I've developed a something of a practice around depressive thoughts and moods and feelings, and so I can summarize it fairly quickly. And part of it, an important part of it, is kind of recognizing the how I I mean, maybe the most important part is recognizing what my relationship to the very idea of depression is. And that, you know, what happened to me was that I started to have experiences when I was young that I identified as depression. And then I identified myself as a depressive, as someone who was depressed a lot. And so I had this relationship that that was an element of who I was, and I had to break that belief system first of all, and understand that how I think of it is I'm somebody who tends to have depressive feelings arise rather than, you know, it's a part of my identity. So I'm sure you understand that, and from a Buddhist viewpoint, the sort of clinging to identity. But in terms of the like immediate process, this is how I try to work with it. When I realize that there's a feeling showing up that I identify as depressive, or if I n realize that a thought has just arisen that I identify as depressive, or if I actually think to myself, I'm depressed. So if any of those things, the feeling, the painful thought, or the naming thought shows up, I essentially stop and try to, first of all, just be there in the experience itself, which is very much the physical, be with the body. Breathe and feel, because for me, the first signs are this kind of darkness, heaviness in my heart, in my belly, in my solar plexus. And I breathe with that. And I, what happens in that moment is that I don't want to feel that. I'm afraid of it. So there's this immediate resistance to actually feeling the feeling. And so the first thing I have to do, really, before, oftentimes before I can even get to the feeling, I have to see if I can let go of the fear. And so, in order to let go of the fear, I have to do something cognitively, which is to remind myself that this is not permanent, that I don't have to be afraid of it. It's just unpleasant. And so feeling it in my that helps me to be like, okay, this is just tap. Like, if I don't get trapped by this, if I don't let this turn into a story and build on it and indulge in it, it will probably pass. So there's this cognitive thing going on, this reflection of the impermanent nature, and then there's this felt experience, this somatic experience of feeling it. And so now I'm with the experience, and what's clear, and I'm moving my arms because it's like it's moving, it's energy, right? It's not solid. It feels kind of heavy and solid, but it's not really solid. So I'm breathing with it. I'm here now. And so that this initial thing of non-resistance, and to see where does my mind want to go, right? And to not follow it there, that really important. Like, I don't, you know, depressive feelings can trigger a whole story about what this means, who I am. It can trigger just a negativity about, oh yeah, because of course, oftentimes the depressive feeling is associated with some reality, like, oh, I just got an email. It's like bad news or something. You know, I got somebody doesn't like me or, you know, whatever the negative thing is. And I can, you know, I can take that kernel of a story and be building on that, right? So all of that needs to be interrupted, the whole thought pr building process, and stay with the felt experience, which is just a feeling that's unpleasant in my body that I have a story about. So I'm staying with the feeling. So that's the initial key thing, is to not like get swept away with it. And then there's the antidotal qualities. Like, what can I do? Not like to get rid of this, but what are like wholesome things to do that, because the depressive feeling is also a passive feeling. And what I want to do is curl up and, like, you know, and just shut my eyes and not do anything. And of course, that just makes it worse. So, oh, skillful responses, get out of the house, take a walk, call a friend, go to a meeting, you know, get into some work, do something constructive, right? It's not trying to get rid of the depressive feeling. It's just saying, I don't have to spend all my time hanging out with this, because so dealing with it doesn't end with, oh, here it is, I feel this, I'm being mindful of this, and this is unpleasant, so I just have to stay with this unpleasant feeling and feel it and breathe with it. No, like, I don't have to stay in it, you know. Then, and this is very much supported by the particular sutta, where the Buddha's like, at a certain point, you can just look away, like, or replace it with something else, do something else. So at that then I'm off and I'm sort of doing other things. And typically what happens to me is that later that day or the next day, I'll notice, like, oh, well, that mood's gone, you know. Or maybe it comes back. I'm like, oh. And, you know, and sometimes then the final component, I would say, I don't know if it's the final component, it's the final one that comes to mind right now, is, you know, there's some stuff going on right now that's bringing this up, you know, this troubling relationship or this difficult event that happened, you know, or this news that I got, you know. And now, like I'm really bothered right now about my knee, you know, my knee hurts. And so my mood comes back to my knee from time to time. And so it's like, okay, there's this thing, and this is just life. Like, there's difficult things in my life, but I don't have to, but I'm not like 24/7 on this just like blah state. It's like, yeah, there's moods come and go, and maybe, as I say, you know, there's an issue going on and I need to deal with that. Like, oh, I'm really not, I really do need to make amends to that person, or I really do need to, you know, work on this thing that's troubling me that I've been avoiding, that's kind of then triggering these underlying feelings. So I don't know if I wish I could break that down a little bit more, like into steps that I could, and I have written about it up. But so that people could sort of more easily see these elements. But I hope that is helpful.
That was very helpful. Thank you very much. I appreciate
Yeah. And so this is recorded. So if anybody wants to go back and, you know, go over that, maybe write it down, might be helpful if it's something that's an issue for you. Unfortunately, the recording, I don't know when it'll be available. We'll get on that soon. Well, that was one question. So thank you, Jamie. I'm taking it that's what it says your name is. It's past the hour, and I have duties to perform other than Dharma teaching duties. So lovely to see everybody. Thanks all for showing up, and We'll pick up on the on renunciation next week. Take care.
Thanks, Kevin.
All right, bye. Oh, end meeting. There we go.